This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today, I'm delighted to talk again to Jonathan Brown. You're most welcome back, sir.
Hi, welcome, and assalamu alaikum to everybody. And it's nice to be back. Although it's funny because I just saw you in person in London.
We did.
Now we're talking, like, now I don't even know if it's 20, maybe 24 hours later. Now I'm in Washington, D.C., and you're not.
I felt particularly embarrassed because we had an English, sort of an English breakfast together, and we ate vegan bacon, these two strips of something.
Yeah, it's not going on my list of best breakfasts, but you know what? No. That's not the point. It was not about the food.
No, but I felt embarrassed. You know, you got an American coming to London, and what did he get? He got this, what in my view is disgusting vegan bacon. Anyway.
But you know, actually, I went to Slough, and they have a place called like Kashmiri Cafe. It's a big building, actually. It's not a little. It's a kind of big building with a park around it, and they have. The guy was kind of. He was like, "Oh, you think you're going to eat all this?" But I ordered full English breakfast and then a Kashmiri breakfast. And they were both individually too big to eat on their own. And so I was really struggling, but it was delicious. So I had a delicious halal English breakfast. So you don't have to worry about that.
No, the food was definitely halal, although questionable integrity. Anyway, I'm going to go there. It was good to see you yesterday. We had a fascinating conversation, but back to today. For those who don't know, Jonathan Brown is a professor and Al Waleed bin Talib Chair of Islamic Civilization in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University in Washington. Is it Washington, D.C., where you are now?
Yep,
cool. He's the author of the following books, Slavery and Islam. There we are. This is a classic work, a very seminal work. And this one, Misquoting Muhammad, The Challenge and Choices of Interpreting the Prophet's Legacy. If you've got any non-Muslim friends, I think it's a particularly good introduction to the subject. One of my favorites is this second edition of Hadith, Muhammad's Legacy in the Medieval and Modern World, because your PhD is in the subject. And this is your PhD, I think. Canonization of al-Bukhari and Muslim, the formation and function of the Sunni Hadith canon. So I recommend all of those. It's actually written also the very short introduction to Muhammad, I think it's called, in the Oxford University very short introduction series, which again is really great for the general reader who doesn't know anything about Islam, I think. So that may not be an exhaustive list of all your books, but those are the ones I've read anyway. I've read all your books. Now, Jonathan's kindly agreed today to discuss his critically acclaimed new book. Yes, there's another one titled, here we go, Islam and Blackness. And what a striking cover that is. I think it's a very brilliant cover, book cover, actually. That's the size of it, newly published with some very positive reviews indeed on the back cover. One, for example, from Imam Zaid Shakir, who's a professor emeritus now of Zaytuna College, another and other scholars as well. And I just want to read just briefly what the dust jacket says on the inside front cover about the book. I assume the publisher wrote this rather than you.
I wrote it.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I think I wrote it. I think they say, what they do is they say, can you write us what to say on the inside of the dust jacket? And then I write it for them. They may check it and say, you know, this makes, I mean, they may, it may, some person might write one that's lousy and they don't use it, but they've always used the ones I sent them. So.
This is about you, though, so it's in the third person. It's commonly claimed, you write, or it says, that Islam is anti-black, even inherently bent on enslaving black Africans. Western and African critics alike have contended that anti-black racism is in the faith's very scriptural foundations and its traditions of law, spirituality, and theology. But what is the basis for this accusation? Best-selling scholar Jonathan A.C. Brown examines scripture, Islamic scripture, law, Sufism, and history to comprehensively interrogate this claim and determine how and why it emerged. Locating its origins in conservative politics, modern Afrocentrism, and the old trope of Barbary Enslavement. That's a particularly common one on the internet, I noticed. He explains how anti-black blackness arose in the Islamic world and became entangled with normative tradition. From the imagery of blackened faces in the Quran to Sharia assessments of black women as undesirable and the assertion that Islam and Muslims are foreign to Africa, this work provides an in-depth study of the controversial knot that is Islam and blackness, and identifies authoritative voices in Islam's past that are crucial for combating anti-black racism today. So that's the book, Islam and Blackness. The subject
I wrote all of that except best-selling author Jonathan Brown. I probably just wrote this book does that, and then they published added that.
Thank you for your honesty there. Yeah, you didn't write that bit. That's okay. So just something we need to clear the decks on this first, Jonathan, if I may. Some people might have an issue with the fact that a white guy, you, has written a book titled Islam and Blackness. And I know there's something that came up recently when you were in London a couple of days ago at SOAS, I think. And actually, this is something you address at the very beginning of your book, immediately, actually. What is your response?
I mean, yeah, I've heard this a lot. I understand people. I mean, I'm not angry at people for having this criticism. It's just that I don't think that it has anything to do with the book. Like, I mean, if I were writing a book about, you know, the experiences of black Muslims, or, you know, even kind of getting into like the fine grains or dynamics of anti-black racism in the modern world, like, you know, maybe my being a white guy is probably not helpful or doesn't give me some kind of, you know, perspective that I need. But this book is about, it's a book of Islamic intellectual history, really. I mean, it's a book about how Muslim scholars over 1400 years dealt with, you know, texts and society interacted, and then how Muslim scholars dealt with their own legal and normative traditions in, you know, surrounding questions of like race and color in their society. So it's really, I mean, I just wonder, like, if I were like a black Muslim in the US, I'm not sure that would give me a lot more insight about what, you know, a text written in like ninth century Baghdad is saying. I mean, it's just sort of, you know, the only way that would make sense is if there was some kind of trans-historical unchanging thing called blackness, so that if you're black in America today, it's the sort of same as being black in Baghdad in the ninth century. And I think that it contradicts basically all the established understandings of race, which say that it's not some kind of essential thing that exists throughout time and space, but rather it's socially constructed. So I think I think that the criticisms are kind of, I mean, I think I understand someone's criticism if they think this is a book about being black and Muslim, or about how challenges of being black and Muslim, but this is a book about the interaction between Islamic normative tradition. Let me just make sure my computer is not gonna ping every couple minutes. Focus. Okay, do not disturb. But you know, that's not what the book is about. The book is about, and the funny thing is, like, we're all foreigners to the past. So none of us is from the past.
Yes.
The past is foreign to all of us.
Yes.
I think it's interesting to think about like what these questions assume about the work. And also, I mean, not to be kind of a pain about this, but someone could say, well, your book's called Islam and Blackness, so, you know, we have concerns about this. Okay, that's fine. I understand. I don't expect people to read the book, but, you know, there is the blurb that you just read, which tells you what the book is about, which I think that if someone read this, I think they would, it would probably make sense why you could have, someone who's not like a black Muslim today writing it. But I would also say that, you know, I mean, I might as well also use this opportunity to just say why I wrote the book. It wasn't like I woke up one day and I said, hey, you know, I really want to write about Islam and blackness or something. I mean, this was not, in fact, when I wrote the slavery book, the Islam and slavery book, people would ask me, oh, you know, you should write, you know, you should write kind of a book on Islam and race or something. And I said, no way. I mean, I said, I'm not crazy. I'm not going to do that. But what happened was in the summer of 2020, there was this debate, which actually I found out later is actually a recurring debate in some circles about that where some scholars, like actual professors in the US in academia, were saying that Islam at its scriptural foundations in the Quran, the Sunnah of the Prophet, right, that the normative tradition of Islam is itself anti-black. Not, you know, Muslims are racist or something, but actually the scriptural foundations normative are anti-black.
Yeah.
So I kept getting these emails forwarded to me from or questions, people, my friend, you know, colleagues asking me like, hey, you know, there's this debate going on and someone's bringing up this hadith and this Quranic verse and this fiqh opinion. And do you have any responses to this? I'm trying to figure out how to respond. And I was like, oh, okay, interesting. So I was like, okay, I'll look at it and I'll try and send you helpful information. And then I started to actually look into it. And I was like, oh, this is actually really interesting. And then I started to, in order to answer those questions, I had to look at other issues. Those raised other questions. Issues of context and history came up. And so before I knew it, I had a book on my hands. And that's how.
So it happened almost, not accidentally, but you had.
It was entirely accidental. It was something where I didn't think. It was a bizarre experience. But I mean, that's sometimes how even the slavery book, I didn't intend really to do it. It kind of came up.
But I noticed this, you do write books that tend to address these popular misconceptions or misunderstanding about Islam, obviously slavery and Islam being one. And this one, I know you told me before, you didn't choose the title of this, Misquoting Muhammad. This is kind of with reference to Bart Ehrman's Misquoting Jesus. But, you know, and you do push back against misunderstandings in this book as well on Hadith. And so you do have a history of really tackling some of these red button issues as they arise in our culture, even though you're not looking for them. They tend to find you, perhaps.
I mean, I think I think what it is that I'm Muslim. And I mean, when I come across these questions, you know, I also have these questions, right? So when I see these, you know, Hadith or a fiqh opinion that seems to be really shocking in the context of blackness, I mean, I also want to know what's going on. So, I mean, I think maybe one of the reasons I do this is that I am a member of the, I'm, you know, curious readers want to know. I'm a curious reader. I want to know the answers to these things as well.
No, that's fair enough. Well, you touched on this briefly, but this is my next question to you. What is the argument of the book? In fact, you have a section of your book. What is the argument of your book? So,
funny you should ask. Yeah, so I have a section in my book called, I actually have this in all my books, I think, which is cool. Yeah,
this is true.
The argument of this book. So if you really don't want to read the book, you can read this section and it will tell you everything, or it will give you a summary.
I'll tell you everything. I'll give you a very, very brief summary. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to read it. It is 2 pages exactly.
Yeah. What page is it again? I can't remember where it is now.
Page 3 and page 3 to 5, but it's.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Though a contested concept, anti-blackness is most succinctly understood as racism directed against people of sub-Saharan African descent. Stereotypes about real or imagined black Africans are nearly as old as historical records. From ancient Rome to medieval China, however, these stereotypes rarely stood out markedly in societies that were often cosmopolitan and where skin color played a less important role than other markers of identity. The notion that the rights and standings of people racialized as black African were determined by that racialization became pervasive only in the early modern period, with the rise of the Atlantic slave trade and Europe's powerful colonial states. The understandings of race and blackness that formed in the West, particularly in the United States, have profoundly shaped global discourse. They have forced a dualistic template of black and white onto social terrains from Mali to Karachi, which are often too dissimilar or complex for such a binary. They have bound black Africanness and slavery in an essential relationship when the link between the two has often been incidental. And they continue to insist that black as a mundane color descriptor cannot be separated from black as a negative metaphor when no such essential relationship exists. Not everyone everywhere, and particularly not speakers of African languages south of the Sahara, has collapsed blackness as skin tone and blackness as metaphor. Neither has aesthetic preference always entailed judgment of human worth. Not all descriptions of color is a prescription of value. In the West, Islam and Muslims have been particularly singled out as anti-black, an accusation emanating from a centuries-old Western stereotype of Muslims as slavers, as well as from contemporary American conservative cultural and political agendas. Anti-blackness is rampant in much of the Muslim world, from North Africa to South Asia. It causes real pain that goes unrecognized, but it does not originate in Islam's scriptures or its system of law and ethics. Islamic civilization inherited stereotypes about black Africans from the Greco-Roman conviction that climate shaped both body and personality, and from Judeo-Christian lore about Africans being cursed with blackness and enslavement. Though prominent Muslim scholars oppose these ideas as antithetical to the Quran, the bulk of Islamic tradition indulged and added to this body of material. While anti-blackness did not define the lives and destinies of people with darker skin tones, from Morocco to India, black African came to stand in for slave and correlate with inferior social status. The Sufi tradition, however, inverted this image, using it to represent the saint's journey from earthly subjugation to liberation through union with the divine. And it portrayed the black African as the pious and devout slave of God who taught and inspired his or her social betters. In Islamic law, particularly norms around marriage, when the correlation of blackness with low status and undesirability was recognized, it was as a social reality that law had to manage, not as a norm for it to protect. Whether in Islamic law or how black Africans have been perceived in other genres of Islamic scholarship, anti-blackness has been incidental, not essential. In law, Muslim jurists recognized that what blackness meant, whether it was attractive or unappealing, depended on where, when, and who was perceiving it. Negative stereotypes about black Africans in Muslim writings on geography and ethnology were often mirrored by stereotypes about Slavs and Turks. And the association of blackness with slavery and primitiveness, including in the writings of many black Muslims from the Sahel, ultimately turned not on phenotype, but on their locating blackness beyond the southern boundaries of the abode of Islam. Whether anti-blackness was incidental or accepted as social customs, however, leading voices of Muslim scholarship from medieval to modern times have rejected it and advocated vigorously for the Prophet's teachings that no race or tribe has any inherent value over another. As judges, jurists, and moral guides, Muslim scholars have had to balance a realistic accommodation of custom with their duty to enjoin right as heirs of the prophets. In light of the severity of the blight of anti-blackness today, it is clear that their duty as moral guides must be to promote an erasure of the color line. Oh. That's that section.
Yeah, very eloquent. I just noticed something in terms of the way you express yourself in this is that the word black itself, sometimes the word like black African is capitalized, the capital B, capital A, but other times you have a small B when the word black is. Yeah. But what's the logic here in switching from capital to non-capital when you're using the word black?
Yeah, so there's a lot of actually writing and debate around this in various academic fields in the US. Primarily in the context of kind of Africana studies in the U.S. kind of Atlantic world, the debate is that black can mean different things. So if I say, you know, like this book cover is black, like that's just a color descriptor, right? Yeah. If I say that a person is black. Well, now, I mean, I've never actually met anyone whose skin was actually this.
Well, exactly. This always struck me as this whole language of black and white. But I look at you.
Yeah. I'm not white.
I don't mean to be rude, but you're more pink, shall we say?
Yeah. So when we use it to talk about people's features, now we're getting kind of into more of a realm of a figurative description, and also not just that, but race, but inscription, right? So somebody might, I mean, for example, languages in a lot of languages in Africa, south of the Sahara, you know, if you ask someone what color is your skin in your language, they'll say black, right? And that doesn't, they're just, that's just a description for them. Doesn't mean anything. But when you say, you know, when a British person or an American person says someone's black, or an Arab person says someone's black, there's also other connotations about that that come through history.
Right.
In addition, this is also very important, right? If you're like Herodotus, you know, we know the famous Greek historian from Allahumma says Muhammad from
400 BC.
Yeah. Oh my God. He's not from Miletus. He's died for about, he's from, it's today, it's Bodrum, Halicarnassus. Yeah. So he, in his, when he talks about Ethiopians being like black, he also says like Indians are also black. So for him, blackness, and this is actually not uncommon in the kind of Greco-Roman tradition, but also in the early Arabic tradition, that blackness is not just something about Africa. It also includes like people who are very dark skin toned in southern India, for example.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So it doesn't. This is important, right? So when we say black in modern, you know, kind of European linguistic traditions, and we're using it as a color to describe someone's phenotype, their presentation, their physical appearance, we also, it's not just their skin color, right? We have associations about what their hair texture is, what their facial feature is, features are, right? So there's all these kind of stereotypical phenotype ideas that come along with saying someone's black. So that's becoming suddenly a lot more complicated than just saying the color black of this book. And so the question is, do we want to put a capital letter there to show that we're not, this is no longer just a neutral kind of normal color description anymore, but now we have other ideas about race and ethnicity and value and history and power coming into it. Then you take another step, right? Which is that some people will, you know, it's very common to find this among scholars in Africana studies, that black can also mean, for example, if I, it's actually interesting. My friend giving me a ride to the airport yesterday is British Muslim. His family is from Zambia. Okay.
Yeah. I actually saw you walking past with him to the car. Yeah, actually.
Exactly. So he went to visit his family members in Zambia, they said, you're not black, you're white. They said to him. It has nothing to do with his skin color. They meant like culturally, you're not from here. Like you're from white men, right? You just use the word, I think it's Mazumbu, I think, is you're one of these, like the word they use for white foreigners, right? So it was really funny because someone's telling him he's not black, right? But in the UK, he's always being told he's black.
Yeah.
So the reason why is for some people, and this includes, by the way, some, you know, scholars and activists in, let's say, Black American culture or anti-racism activism in the U.S., where they'll say that black with a capital B is not for people in Africa, from Africa. It's for people who are part of this diaspora community that had the experience of enslavement, of being taken away, of growing up in these kind of almost like Creole communities that have different cultural and racial kind of inputs into them in the 400 years or so since the, or four, even 500 years of the Atlantic slave trade and the European enslavement of Africans and then exploitation of their labor in the Americas and then the growth of these diaspora communities in the Americas, right? So in this case, black would mean, you remember when President Obama was, there was these debates about whether Obama is black or not. Mm-hmm. People were about, what the heck is this? I thought he was black. But the idea is some people would say he's not black because he doesn't share, his father was from Kenya. You know, his mother was white. Idea is that he doesn't share this black experience in terms of enslavement, segregation, oppression, exploitation of communities that come out of the diaspora. So there's all these debates about what black means, and people have come up with various ways, kind of conventions for using capitalization to indicate this. I think it's difficult because on the one hand, you want to kind of acknowledge and abide by these conventions. On the other hand, the problem is if you start to capitalize and not capitalize, it sort of becomes unmanageable because you're reading, let's say, some 10th century Muslim jurist or 11th century Muslim historian in Baghdad or Cairo or something, and he says someone's black, and you're like, do I capitalize this or not? I mean, I don't know what do they mean by this. I mean, if I capitalize or don't cap, you know, then I might be imposing my reading of what he's trying to say onto something that he might not mean. So what I say in the book is, you know, if we're going to talk about like black British or black American, we'll talk about, you know, capital B, capital A, right? Black American.
Yeah.
If we're talking about blackness as like a modern construct that we're discussing in the context of race and everything, I use capital B. But generally I just default to lowercase because otherwise it becomes, you know, you sort of, you end up backing yourselves into yourself into a corner and forcibly interpreting for the reader something that maybe the reader should be able to kind of encounter unmediated.
Okay, well, from that very sophisticated theoretical analysis of the dilemmas of how we capitalize words, I want to go to perhaps another extreme. In my experience at Speaker's Corner here in London, this occasional bear pit of a place, don't necessarily recommend it. A lot of Muslims go there. A lot of Christian missionaries go there, and they're not terribly mainstream. They're they're definitely anti-Muslim. They all are, actually. I think it was one exception who wasn't polemical and hostile. One particular issue amongst a number, one that came up repeatedly, still does sometimes, is what you call in your book the so-called raisin-headed hadith. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to quote it because I'm not actually sure. Well, you say that it comes in different variants anyway. It's not like a single hadith. Some do mention the raisin-headed hadith words, others don't. But it's in Bukhari as well. But the accusations of anti-black racism in the Sunnah is the point here. And now, personally, I don't have an issue with it. I mean, what I think is not really the point. But what is the most likely wording of this hadith? And why is it problematic? And how do you respond to it? I mean, is it an example of racism from the Prophet himself?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think so. The hadith itself occurs in several variations. The general, the pretty consistent part is that you should obey your commander. So it's in the context of essentially like being on a military campaign.
Right.
So obey your commander, even if he is, so some versions will say like a mutilated slave, like a slave who's had his like nose cut off or ears. This is something you see in the kind of Byzantine tradition, actually, that sometimes slaves would be like mutilated, like have their nose parts of their ears cut off. And then some versions say, you know, even if he's an Ethiopian slave.
Right.
And then some versions say, even if he's an Ethiopian slave who's Rasu Kazabiba, his head is like a raisin, right? So the general meaning of the hadith is very clear. It's not really disagreed on, right? Which is that says that whoever is your commander, you obey them. It doesn't matter if they're someone you think is socially higher you or socially lower than you. Even if it's the lowest person in the society, this kind of mutilated slave, they're in charge, you obey them.
Right.
This was then interpreted, extended kind of analogically to apply to any kind of official in authority. So one of the instances in which the hadith is actually transmitted, and the main transmitter of the hadith, the companion Abu Dharr al-Ghifari, he settles after the death of the Prophet, he settles at a place called Rabadha, which is like kind of a, If you were go on the trail from Mecca, Medina to southern Iraq, you would pass. It's sort of like a station way. And it's where all the zakat camels, the camels who were collected for charitable tax were pastured there. So he lived there. And an official under the Umayyad government is brought out to, or the Muslim government is brought to, is there like assessing for taxation. And the official is a an Ethiopian slave whose job is to do this, right? So the prayer time comes, and the, you know, everyone's like, okay, Abu Dharr, this seen, you know, very old, you know, companion to the prophet, they say, you should lead us in prayer. And Abu Dharr says, no, like you, the gesturing to the Ethiopian slave official, he says, you should lead us because the prophet said, you know, obey your commander, even if he's Ethiopian slave, right? So he's almost interpreting this hadith. You can, and so that becomes used, well, not just that, but just the general meaning of the hadith is generally, it's also understood to apply to any official who's in authority. You obey them, even if they're someone you think is lower than you. Okay. Now, let's put that aside. That's pretty simple. The issue is, so everything about the hadith is fairly straightforward, except this one clause, which appears in one actually very rare narration of the hadith. This narration is in Sahih Bukhari, but it's bizarre because it's not in other books. It's actually not the most reliable narration of the hadith. If you were to get all the different narrations of the hadith, the part that has the clause that says his head like a raisin, that is actually a minority clause, right? So this is specifically in one version. It's not the most reliably transmitted version. It's in Sahih Bukhari, so there's no, people don't really debate its authenticity. But if you were to, you know, if you were to say, like, look, we have lots of different versions of this hadith, which is the most reliable? It would not be. It would be the least reliable version. Okay.
Sure.
Well, but no pre-modern scholar that I know of, and no modern hadith scholar that I know of, has ever argued that this clause is somehow false or has been added in. So let's deal with it.
But indeed, you say to continue in the book that in the early centuries of hadith commentators, this was not understood, this particular clause or the whole hadith in any way is pejorative in a negative way at all. It was only much later that it was understood with perhaps more racist overtones.
The earliest descriptions of scholars in like the 900s and 1000s. They just say, it just means that, for example, Ethiopian people's heads are like dark, you know, their skin is like dark color, like a raisin. And they also say that they talk about the texture of like tightly coiled African hair. They say it looks like peppercorns. So if you have... it looks like a bunch of peppercorns together. The texture of the, like the outside, the kind of wrinkly texture of the peppercorns. Yep. So they say that it's the color and the texture of the raisin is like the texture of their hair. They just say like, this is what the prophet means. And then they move on. They don't have a problem with it. Incidentally, I mean, I should add right now that it's hard to, if you look at how African Muslim scholars use this hadith, it's the same, right? So they don't have, let's say like scholars like Muhammad Bello, the second ruler of the Sokoto Caliphate in what's now Northern Nigeria, people like his father, Osman Danfadio, died in 1817, the founder of the Sokoto Caliphate. People like Sheikh Muhammad Amin al-Harari, who just died a few years ago, who's actually Ethiopian, right? So he's not just, he's actually the exact ethnicity that's being described.
Yeah. In the hadith.
None of them have any, they don't ever say anything about the hadith that indicates that they consider it to be like offensive or something. They just, in fact, Muhammad Bello and Osman Danfodio, they just use it, they actually use it in instructions to their commanders, like in how to act on campaign. So what does happen roughly in the sort of 1200s, 1100s, 1200s, amongst Hadith scholars who are living from kind of in the kind of Cairo, Syria, greater Syria, kind of Iranian world, is you see a shift to a much more pejorative language, right? So what they'll say, again, they're not trying to say anything pejorative, but the way they read it shows much more of a kind of social openness or contextual openness to a negative meaning. So they'll say things like
The reason why the prophet is using this example is because, you know, Ethiopian black slaves are the sort of the most disregarded, sort of lowest rung of the social ladder. They'll say that they're, you know, that they're, the smallness of their heads has to do with like their stupidity, their lack of reason, their ugliness, right? So you get a lot of like, just kind of a lot more negativity. Whereas the early commentators, they're just like, it's color and texture, and that's it. And they don't really go into it anymore. So there's definitely after the 1200s, and that really continues into the, you know, essentially early modern period, or maybe even to the modern period, depending where you're looking, that the negativity really, it becomes much more pejorative, and you see kind of the reading into much more reading into the stereotypes about ugliness and stupidity and lowliness.
Because I know this is purely subjective, but I know some Ethiopian brothers in London. I would never ever think they were ugly or stupid. I mean, it's just, I'm just wondering where this idea comes from. It's not obvious that this would be something that could be said. And even the raisin head thing, maybe I need to go look at some Google images of raisins, but I just, it's not obvious to me that this is a connected description either. But hey, I mean,
here's the thing. Like, I mean, so what's interesting is I remember I was reading this French ethnographer did a study on this in the 1960s on this oasis in Algeria. And she talks about describing the hair of some of the people who live there. She says it looks like peppercorns, which I thought was really, I was like, wow, like this is a person who's coming with the same description of peppercorns, not raisin. But I would say that it's interesting, right? The one of the kind of pitfalls of this sort of looking into the past is that we tend, especially on issues of race and blackness, there's kind of been this globalization of American conceptualizations of race and what it means, not just kind of globally today, but actually kind of retroactively, imperially into the past. So it's sort of Western, you know, it's like American cultural conquest, not just of the present, but of the past, which is kind of a horrific way. And so there's always this idea that what blackness means to Americans is somehow what it means to everybody in the past, which is, or the present, which is just totally untrue. Yeah. So one thing you find that's very interesting is, and by the way, this is the same thing with Herodotus. Herodotus talks about the Ethiopians being the handsomest people. The handsomest race, right?
Interesting.
Then what's interesting is there's a book written in the 1500s, the late 1500s, by a Medinan scholar named Ibn Abd al-Baqi, who's actually a khatib, like a guy who gives the sermon, the Friday sermon at the Prophet's Mosque in Medina. So him, you know, you can see in his work, in other works from the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, early 1900s from the Hejaz, including foreigners who go there, like Snu Cogronia, the Dutch foreigner, like this one Scottish traveler, Bruce, who travels there in the 1700s trying to find the source of the Nile. They all say the same thing and they note the same thing, which is the people in the Hejaz are absolutely obsessed with Ethiopian women. And by Ethiopian, they mean both kind of Horn of Africa, so Ethiopia and Somalia. These are considered the most beautiful women, and they're obsessed. So this one guy, Ibn Abd al-Baqi's teacher, he's writing all this love poetry about Ethiopian women, how much he longs for them, and he has like some concubines who are Ethiopian, and it's so bad that he also has to write a poem to his wife apologizing for his obsession with Ethiopian women. So on the one hand, you could say, well, these people are definitely not ugly, according to Hejazi men from the, as far as I know, the 1500s, pretty consistently from the 1500s to the 1900s. Okay. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, Ibn Abd al-Baqi in the same book, right? I mean, he has a whole section about the beauty of Ethiopian women. And then he moves on to how ugly Zanj women are. They're ugly. They're stupid. They are lousy parents. They're God. I mean, just so what is Zanj? Zanj for him, and the general way it's used in its in kind of Arab Islamic civilization is it's people from further south on the East African coast. So kind of you can imagine kind of Ethiopia and Somalia, and then you're going south down into, you know, Kenya, Tanzania, Malawi, that area, right? That those people brought in from the inland on and on the coast. So these people he sees as completely different, and he considers them extremely ugly. And this is very widely held in kind of Islamic civilization in the medieval to the early modern period, roughly from North Africa across through the Middle East into Iran and northern India. Very common opinion. But the reason I bring this up is you see like that this something that we in the US would just categorize as black, that for someone like Ibn Abd al-Baqi are two totally different groups that he has absolutely diametrically opposed assessments of in terms of their beauty.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely that's very fascinating, actually. I think we have to ask the question just for the record, in case anyone is unaware, what did the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, teach about race and what really matters to God? Because he did teach things. So,
I mean, the Quranic rule is very simple, right? Akramakum indallahi atqakum. The most noble in God's eyes is the most noble of you, according to God, is the most pious, the one with the most taqwa. Okay. And of course, we also have the Prophet alayhi salam saying that, you know, that in his famous farewell sermon, the Arab has no virtue over the non-Arab, and the non-Arab has no virtue over the Arab except by their deeds. And the black and the black and the red, which is interesting, we can get into that if you want. He's the black has no person has no virtue over the red, and the red has no virtue over the black person except in their deeds.
So what is red? Sorry, because I actually don't know what is red in the modern.
It's very interesting. So early Islamic Arabic and kind of pre-Islamic Arabic, as far as we know, if you're going to use a bipartite division for people for their appearances, so two groups, you have black and red. So and most scholars would say that Arabs were in the black group. So Arabs would lump themselves with Ethiopians, Southern Indians, and everyone like that, right? So they would say we're black. The reds would be people who are like lighter skinned from maybe the north and the Mediterranean, kind of Syrian, Anatolian populations, right? So that's how they said black and red, which is interesting, by the way, because when you go back and you look at, let's say, ancient Egyptian artwork, and even some of the pre-Islamic Arab depictions of, we have some like at Qaryat al-Faw from roughly maybe 200 or 300 AD, 300 of the Common Era, place that's about kind of south east of Mecca. There are some wall paintings, and it's the same as the way Egyptians are portray themselves in kind of ancient Egyptian art that we all know about, right? They draw themselves a red color, almost like an ochre color. So they call themselves red. Whereas they'll portray like a Nubian or an Ethiopian as literally black colored, like this book color, or sometimes a kind of light, a brownish color, a lighter black. So it's interesting that, you know, this idea of considering what we might think of as like an Arab or Middle Eastern phenotype being more red colored than anything. But what's also interesting is when, that's not very common, right? So generally when Arabs talk about, they'll either, early Islamic Arabic, pre-Islamic Arabic, you either have the bipartite division of red and black, or you have a tripartite division of black, white, and red. Black being very dark-skinned, including Europeans or dark-skinned Arabs. White would be sort of what we think of like a Mediterranean complexion, which is interesting because who came up with the idea of saying white people was the Romans. The Romans used the word albus to talk about a Mediterranean complexion. You and I, Paul, would not be white for ancient Romans or for, you know, Republican or early imperial Romans. We would be what's called pallidus or candidus, which means pallid. We're basically pallid colored. We're not white for in the Roman kind of taxonomy of phenotype and color. But the white, kind of that idea of a Mediterranean look, is what also what the Arabs meant when they said white. It's sort of like, so the Prophet alayhi salam was described as white.
Exactly. This is, I was just going to ask you on that very point, because it has caused some controversy in terms of, he wasn't really an Arab or something, because he's described as white.
What that means is he sort of has like a, you know, medium olive tone, a kind of a, you know, sort of a Mediterranean picture, kind of an Arab or Italian or Greek. Anthony Quinn, let's go. I feel like that's how Anthony Quinn, you know.
Because did he play Hamza in the Message, the film, I mean?
Yeah, he did. I mean, I don't know. He also played Audah Abu Tai in Lawrence of Arabia and Zorba the Greek and God and another guy in Allahumma Sayyid Muhammad in Guns of Navarone. But I don't know if how much makeup Anthony Quinn had.
Well, this is true. He could have been heavily made up. But
think of Anthony Quinn in all those movies, and that's probably a pretty good, you know. But I mean, the point is that he's sort of, he's a Greek and he's an Arab at the same time. So that's white. So you have black, white, and then red, which again is sort of like a lighter skinned Mediterranean person, a lighter skinned Persian person, Turks, Byzantines, Russians. What's interesting is when Muslim geographers start to either travel to or hear reports about Northern Europeans, people like the British, Celts, Irish people, they're just, it's like off the radar for them. They don't know. They're like, they say they're red colored. They say they're blue colored. They have this stringy red hair, stringy blonde.
Oh, no, but that might be because the Celts sometimes were portrayed with wearing blue makeup.
That might be it, but my guess is, and I don't know for sure, my guess is that it's, if you people who look really, really white, light skin, you can kind of see their veins, the blue of their veins a lot. That's my guess. But the woad thing might be it.
I'm going to go for the woad thing. I prefer it because it's a more exotic explanation.
Yeah, I mean, but yeah, that's an interesting question. So, now, what's interesting is as well and very important is that I just mentioned that when early Islamic, you know, kind of Arabs of the time of the Prophet and early Islamic Arabia, pre-Islamic Arabia, if they're going to talk about people's looks, they'll say either red and black as the divisions or black, white, and red. If they use black and white, they don't use it for people's appearances. So black and white is a metaphoric.
Right.
It's metaphoric. It means noble and ignoble. So if you're,
when this term is used in the Quran and the Sunnah and so on, people with black faces, not to understand that as a racial classification, then
it's not. No. If you say in the Quran, it talks about, for example, when people hear news of that they have a daughter, their face is blackened. On the Day of Judgment, there will be faces that are blackened and faces that are whitened.
Yeah.
This doesn't mean they suddenly look like an African person, or they suddenly look like, you know, David Bowie or something. This is not what this means, right? And Muslim commentators are very clear about this. First of all, they debate whether or not it's just totally metaphorical and not physical at all. But in the case, let's say, for example, in this world, it's obviously metaphorical, right? Because it's not like your face gets dark or colored when you get bad news. If anything, you might get lighter colored. The blood drains out of your face. But in terms of the afterlife, when the believers, their faces are whitened, and the disbelievers, their faces are blackened, what they say is this is obviously the whiteness of nobility and ennoblement before God, and the blackness of perfidy and kind of debasement before God. And what if they say it's physical, what they'll say it's a sawad yukhalif kul anwa as-sawad, right? So it's blackness that differs from any kind of blackness in this world. It's an otherworldly color that is not related to phenotype. Like, it's not like everybody who, you know, again, it's nothing to do with black and white in this world. And what's really interesting is when you go to, let's say, famous Arab poets who are writing in the 800s, like Al-Mutanabbi, but at this time, right, when their commentators are writing in the 900s and 1000s, by this time, you know, anti-blackness has become common amongst Muslim scholars from Iraq to Iran in that time. It's they've been influenced by the same kind of anti-blackness you'll see in the rest of the Mediterranean world, which we can discuss later if you want. But what's interesting is even those scholars who are culturally primed to see black people as lower and white people as higher, when someone like Al-Mutanabbi uses saying like this guy is black or this guy is white, they don't interpret it. They'll, in their descriptions, they'll say, oh, he means noble and ignoble, right? So the strength of this notion that black and white as a distinction is really something that is first and foremost metaphoric. Right. That persists even after anti-blackness has become rampant.
Right. That's interesting. When I read chapter 4 of your book, Islam and Blackness, I didn't realize, but I started on the first sentence, I didn't realize it was a quote, and that maybe that's deliberate, the shock value. The chapter is entitled The Western Narrative of Islam, Slavery and Anti-Blackness. And the chapter begins, I'll just read the first couple of verses, I was going to say, a couple of sentences. The Muslim slave trade was 200 times greater than the American slave trade. Moreover, while Westerners had fought to an end slavery globally, Muslims continue to buy and sell human beings. White guilt, it would seem, was uncalled for. And then you say, so tweeted the Canadian far-right identitarian Stephen Molyneux in 2018, not long before he was banned from the platform. And absolutely right. So the question really is about the Barbary slave trade in part. And this also, it has a theme that's come up at Speaker's Corner and certainly on social media as well. And I'll just read a sentence from Wikipedia, which I looked up earlier, about this, the Barbary slave trade. It says, involved slave markets on the Barbary coast of North Africa, which included the Ottoman states of Algeria, Tunisia, and the Sultanate of Morocco between the 16th and 19th centuries. European slaves were acquired by Barbary pirates in slave raids on ships and by raids on coastal towns from Italy to the Netherlands and Ireland and southwest Britain. As far north as Iceland, I didn't know that, and into the eastern Mediterranean. So this is like a huge, almost global slave trade. So in terms of Western narratives on Islam, slavery, and anti-blackness, I mean, this, what is going on with the Barbary slave trade, and why is it, why are you talking about it in your book on Islam and blackness?
Yeah, well, it's very important when we think about the way in which this notion of Islam is anti-black, how this idea comes about and how it's, why it continues so strongly. And what I say is that it's can be traced back to, I'm going to say, three or four kind of root causes. I'll list the root causes and we'll count how many I listed in the end. So the first one is this idea, which is very present in Western Europe from France, Spain, England, and then also in the American colonies of the Northern United States, what becomes the United States, right? This idea that Islam and Muslims are, so Islam is a slaver religion and Muslims are slavers. So this association. Now, in this case, it's enslaving Europeans. So yep. What happens is from roughly the 1500s until really the early 1700s is kind of the heyday of this, of the Barbary slave trade, is that pirates, raiders operating out of, Algiers, especially Morocco, Tunis, to a certain extent, are capturing French, Italian, British, and American ships and capturing the crews and the passengers, if they're passengers, and keeping them in slavery, usually for purposes of ransoming them, right? So they want to ransom them back to their families for money, right? So that's the Barbary slave trade. And this is like this is a real issue. One guy who is a famous guy who is, remember, that's what Robinson Crusoe in his story, he talks about being, in fact, I think maybe even the author was captured at one point. We can look that up, or the viewers can look this up.
Robert Louis Stevenson, the author, I'm trying to remember who the author
is. No, who the hell is the author of?
Because I haven't actually read the book.
Robinson Crusoe.
Anyway,
I'm forgetting who wrote this book. Anyway, so that, but yeah. It's a very early novel, so it's much earlier than Robert Louis Stevenson.
Yeah.
But the John Smith, the guy who's one of the founding figures in the Jamestown colony, was also captured by pirates.
Right.
Now, these Muslim pirates, these raiders, it's a real cause of fear in the kind of public imagination. In fact, the song Rule Britannia, Britannia rule the waves, Britons never, ever will be slaves. What is it talking about? This is actually talking about the being powerful at sea and then not being enslaved. By being captured by the pirates. Right. So this is very important. And this persists in popular imagination until the present day. You know, I have a list in my appendix in my book of all the movies, including some movies in the 1990s and 2000s that have totally extraneous scenes of white women or white, especially white women, being auctioned at these North African slave markets. This is today, it's like a vestigial, but in some of the earliest, one of the earliest genres of films it's called the Sheikh genre, where white Europeans, especially women, get captured and sort of romance / seduced by these Sheikh figures, right? So there's this very mixed up, like there's a lot of, you know, you could put kind of British and American culture on the couch for some analysis here, because on the one hand, they're terrified of being captured. On the other hand, there's like, they're terrified of falling in love. Another thing, by the way, there's a lot of obsession with the idea that Muslims will sodomize you. This is a huge theme in this Barbary narrative, is that you're going to get sodomized by the Muslim captive. It's a little too, there's a little too much focus on it, in my opinion. Okay? So, I'm not a psychologist.
No, but in our post-Freudian era, it's impossible not to see deeper reasons.
What happens is this.
Just to say, it was Daniel Defoe. I just looked it up. So you're much earlier than the person I mentioned. Yeah.
So what happens is, what's interesting though, is by the early 1700s, the strength of the Royal Navy and of other European navies has actually turned the table. So after that, it's actually more European pirates and raiders and ships who are capturing Muslims in the Mediterranean. And there's a very, brisk trade in slaves of Muslims from Morocco and Algeria and that area being captured at sea and sold as slaves in cities like Naples, Genoa, up through the mid to late 1800s, or the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, really kind of, healthy trade of slaves being Muslims captured at sea and brought and sold as slaves, usually domestic slavery in places like Naples and Genoa. So what I'm trying to say is that it transforms from a reality into this kind of phantasm that remains kind of a potent part of the European mind, Western European mind, and American mind until the present day.
Mm. Yeah.
Their board games, their novels, their films, their everything. What's interesting is not only do you have a genre of people writing really their own experiences, kind of coming back and saying my time as a captivity in the Barbary's and on the Barbary coast, but it also becomes something where people write fake ones. So you get people writing these best-selling stories of how I was captured, especially British or American women, how I was captured by these Moorish slavers and their horrible, like, black African slaves, and that they're made up there. So this is like, there's a hot market for this. So that's one important origin for this. The second is, so we say, well, what does that have to do with blackness? Okay, here's the second part. After the abolitionist movement, which is based mainly in northern United States and Great Britain, really has its big victories in the early 1800s, in the 1830s, in 1807 with the end of the British banning on the slave trade in most of the British.
Read all about in your other book, by the way. A very interesting read there. Yep.
In the 1830s with the prohibition of slavery in Britain and many of its colonies, not all.
Colonies. Oh, not all. Okay.
Yeah. And then... is attention starts to turn amongst abolitionists to non-Atlantic slave trade. So the Atlantic slave trade has been crippled significantly. Then they start talking about, okay, they say there's two kinds of slavery. There's the Christian slave. They say it was incorrectly called the Christian slave trade. It has nothing to do with Christianity, but Europeans did this. We've now stopped. The other type is the Mohammedan slave trade. And so for the kind of Europeans and Americans thinking about slavery globally after the 1830s, the only other show in town for them is what they call the Mohammedan slave trade. And so this is, of course, completely inaccurate. It's not inaccurate to say that Muslims were engaged in the slave trade in, let's say, trans-Saharan or across the Red Sea or in the Indian Ocean. Yes, of course, Muslims were involved in this. No one's denying that, right? But the idea that it's only Muslims doing this is totally incorrect. We know that inside, there's all these intra-African kind of circuits of slave trade, whether it's from what's now like northern kind of Nigeria down to the southern coast of places like Ghana, or whether it's Christian, the Christian emperor Menelik II in Ethiopia in the late 1800s, who's expanding his state and capturing and enslaving other Ethiopians and non-Ethiopian Africans. And so this is a Christian ruler who's doing this. But the point is that from this point on, from really the mid-1800s onward, you get the idea that the Arab Muslim slaver, now their other target is the Black African, the peaceful Black African native who's just, you know, and this is not my idea, but this is how it's portrayed, you know, they're out and, you know, dancing and doing various noble savage things, and then the evil Arab Muslims come in and enslave them. Remember, well, first of all, what are some of the most successful early films? Tarzan movies in the 1920s. Why in Edward Rice Burroughs' novels and in the movies, why is Tarzan there? Why is his family there that they can be washed up on the coast and he can grow up and be raised by whatever, the tiger or the monkey or the gorilla, right? Why is it? His family is part of an the British effort to end the Arab slave trade, right? So now you have a new theme, a new story, which is the white British and Americans who've come in to help save the Africans, the Black Africans, from the evil Arabs, the evil Arab slave traders. Okay, then you add, here's the third root cause. Where both of these ideas are now kind of bubbling in the Western cultural imagination, the kind of vocabulary of Western European and American culture, Arab slavers, Arabs as enslaving Black people. If you're a conservative who's trying to claim the kind of moral high ground of Western civilization or its sort of role in the vanguard of human moral perfection or moral advancement, this is a great way to kind of shift the blame. So you can say, yes, we were engaged in the slave trade, but we repented. We tried to end slavery. The Muslims never did. The Arab Muslims they never repented. They're still doing it. This is what the Stephen Molyneux was doing. And by the way, he's just one person. If you just, Douglas Murray says the same, he said the same thing on Bill Maher's show after the book press, he came on the show and said this. You can find it. If you just go look at kind of these more conservative or sort of West is best, West supremacist figures in the public life, they'll regularly bring the idea that the Muslim slave trade was equivalent to the Atlantic slave trade. And unlike Europeans who realize it was wrong, Muslims have never realized it's wrong, right? You see this over and over again. In fact, and I go into this in some detail in my book, it's not, it may be true. It's very hard to calculate, but it may be true that from around 700 AD until 1900 AD, that slightly more people were removed from Africa than were removed from Africa by Western Europeans. But one has to remember that the Western European slave trade is basically, you know, three centuries, roughly three, you know, essentially three and a half centuries, Whereas, so you're talking about 3.5 centuries worth of enslavement compared to, 12 centuries, 1200 years or 1300 years. So the intensity and the violence of the European slave trade is, I think, is not comparable. It's far more severe than these various kind of Muslim Islamic slave trades. And of course, then there's all sorts of problems about calling anything like Muslim slave trade, Islamic slave trade. What does that mean? I mean, what does it mean if somebody somebody one day becomes Muslim and they're still a slave trader? Is that now the Islamic slave trade? Some of these people engaged in the slave trade are local African potentates. I mean, this was very common. You didn't go, it wasn't like these raiders went in and just started grabbing people. They would go and buy them from people who had already captured them or who were selling their own members of their own communities. So I'm not trying to say that, Muslims have no blame or Arabs have no blame and all this. By the way, then Arab slave raiders from the Gulf, for example, would go to Zanzibar in the 1800s and they would just start raiding the Zanzibar island and taking Muslims. They would start taking the local Muslims as slaves. And this is something that the Sultan is and local communities are extremely angry about, writing protest letters. Like, you can't, these people come from like what's now UAE area, kind of Persian Gulf area, come down and raid and taking people who are Arab speaking Muslims as slaves. So it's a very complicated. Anyway, so the point I want to make is that you have this idea of the Arab as slaver and Arab as enslaving blacks, and the Arab as the kind of unrepentant, uncured slaver is very useful for Western conservatives who want to push for like a West is best, Western superiority to others narrative. Now, who then picks this up? The fourth very important kind of source for this, not temporal source, but in terms of who's driving it, like who's really revving this engine and keeping it going, is Israeli public diplomacy. This is, someone might say, oh, here he goes. Protocols of Elders of Zion.
Yeah, you call it Zionist. You mentioned Israeli Zionists and others. Yeah,
this is well documented. I didn't go and document this. This is well documented, right? That the role of Israeli public diplomacy, either by American Zionists or by Israelis, in one, Islamophobia, the propagation of what Nathan Lean calls the Islamophobia industry. Two, the narrative of Muslims as anti-black. A lot of films that have these plots are produced by Israeli producers. They're produced in Israel with Israeli actors, right? Why is this useful?
Yeah, the question is why. Yeah, so what's the reason?
That Israel was one of the earliest supporters of the South Sudanese liberation movement in the 1960s. It allows you to break the solidarity, the kind of, first of all, Cold War, Third World, non-aligned movement, colonized world movement of solidarity between colonized people. So Black Africans and Arabs, maybe North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa, right? You break the solidarity between them by promoting the idea that the Arab North and Muslim North is a predatory slaving force on the real Africa, right? Quote unquote, the real Africa. Then another thing is they'll highlight anti-blackness in Middle Eastern Arab society. So they'll say, and you can see this, it'll come out every couple of months. You don't have to go back and look in history. Just wait around and watch for discourse online. When you have someone like Allahumma Sayyid Muhammad, I forget his name. I'm forgetting his name, but every time there's like kind of effort or by some kind of Black American thinkers or writers to talk about solidarity with Palestinians between like Black, Black Lives Matter and Palestinian lives, you'll see in like Jerusalem Post or something will pop up an article saying, oh, how do you have solidarity with Arabs when they think they call Black people slaves? And, Saudi Arabia and Palestine, these are all, places where they treat Black people terribly. So there's a you'll repeatedly see this idea of Arab society and Arab culture as anti-Black brought up in Israeli media, in pro-Israel media in the West, to fragment or fracture the possibility of kind of Black Muslim or Black Arab or Black Palestinian solidarity.
It's a very strategy, isn't it, to manipulate public opinion with a view to protecting the what some have called the apartheid policies of the state of Israel by, as you say, fracturing
Human Rights Watch has referred to it as this.
Yeah,
by division, divide and rule,
basically, yeah. By bringing in this. So, and this, and in like the other examples of going off subject, but where public opinion is manipulated to reach certain conclusions on events that happen in our world. So we don't live in a, you know, we've got to be wary of fake news and how we're being manipulated.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, but just draw to a close. But I was struck by a sentence very early on. I was struck for several reasons in your book, in your preface. you said one comment on social media, however, stuck with me. A Black Muslim asked me with the sincerity of a Muslim brother, "Do you know what it feels like to be considered subhuman?" And you replied, "I do not." Once in the outskirts of Dhaka, as I sat with the family that raised me there, a toddler came into the yard, saw me, and started bawling in fear. That is the one time in my life that I've ever felt singled out by my race. And it was more entertaining than anything else, you said. Throughout my life, I have been treated like royalty at home and abroad. And I thought, that's very revealing. I can actually, in a smaller way, relate to that. When I went to California, San Francisco airport, just a week or so ago, long queue of people. And you know, I was anticipating being interrogated or asked questions. And I knew what questions they'd ask because I heard everyone else being asked them ahead of me. So what's your length of your stay? And what's the purpose of your visit? And I saw people in front of me, people of different ethnicities, you know. One woman was taken away. I don't mean him screaming. I mean, she was, you know, a guy, the immigration guy said,
yeah,
can you come over here, please? And this person came away and took this woman away for, I don't know, questioning. I have no idea why. And then came my turn. So I was all prepared for questioning. And the whole interview lasted about 4 seconds. I remember it was like, purpose of visit. I was saying, seeing friends. How long are you going to be here for? 5 days. Off you go. And it was like, whoosh, straight through. And I thought, hang on, that's it, you know. And why, you see? Because I've been told all these stories by Muslim friends of mine, Muslim brothers, who most of whom are not white, about the experiences they had at US immigration. And I'm not, there's not a point about US immigration particularly, but same in Britain as well and elsewhere. And I didn't have that problem. And I have never had that problem. Maybe I will now. But your experience of being treated like royalty, this sense of effortlessness of just passing through things, of being accorded a welcome, and it almost becomes norm, the normal behavior. And it's not the experience of many of our brothers and sisters who share the same views, the same faith, sometimes the same marriages and so on. And
yeah.
this whole notion of white privilege, whatever that may mean, but nevertheless, comes home with renewed force. I thought in that comment in your book and in my recent experience in the United States, I'm not complaining, by the way, I'm glad I got through your country's immigration very easily, but I was aware that how different it could have been for some people I know.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, if you were to, or if I were to be wearing like a shalwar kameez, and have like a big beard and a, you know, like a little Pakistani hat on or something.
Yeah.
I think we would get treated very differently. And that's not to say that there's, that's not to kind of try to problematize the notion of white supremacy, I think, or white privilege. I think these are, you know, very well established facts. But I think what it means is that this idea of the racial Muslim, right, that being racialized as Muslim is not necessarily about your actual ethnicity or your skin color, but that there are other signs you send of your Muslimness.
Yes. And
those will also racialize you as a Muslim.
Yes.
In the eyes of the other. And I think this is important because sometimes people will kind of be like, you know, there's no race. Muslim is not a race. This is nonsense. How can you say this? And it's, you know, understand where they're coming from, because they're like, look, all the race is about your kind of your ancestry and how you look and things like this. And, you know, Muslims look like everything and they have all sorts of ancestries. But the fact of the matter is, in the eyes of the sort of general non-Muslim public, there are certain signals that mean Muslim. And that if you give those signals, then you'll be racialized as a Muslim. And you can't get out of that, right? There's nothing you can do. You can't say, you know, to the guy at the border, I'm moderate. I have no problematic views. I'm wonderful. I love baseball.
I'm a Sufi sheikh, and I
won't matter, right? You've become racialized as a Muslim. That's what this concept of racialization means, is this notion of people reading into you something, people more powerful than you reading into something about you that they make indelible and unalterable.
Anyway, it was a wake-up call. Perhaps we can conclude there. And this is the book we've been talking about, Islam in Blackness, with this incredible cover by your good self. It's quite substantial, with some very positive reviews indeed from very distinguished scholars and experts in the field on the back cover. I do recommend it. It's not been out long. Presumably it will come out in paperback in due course, I assume.
Yeah, I think so, usually. And I usually try and stuff some extra things into the paperback. they'll send me I'll say, I try to stuff more stuff into the footnotes, you know. Yeah. So the paperback versions of my book actually have stuff the hardbacks don't have. They have more stuff, more data stuffed in there.
Gosh. And I'm gonna plug another one of your books that's one of my favorite by you, is I'm misquoting Muhammad, The Challenge and Choices of Interpreting the Prophet's Legacy in the Contemporary World. This is an outstanding introduction to the whole subject of Islam and how we interpret the Islamic tradition today. You tackle a lot of really thorny issues about 434. We're not going to go then, Quran 434. Lying about the Prophet, and when scripture can't be true, these ideas, some people saying no to the scripture because they don't agree with it, and hermeneutics, interpretation. So it's full of history and narrative, as well as taking on board complex theoretical questions about how in the modern world we understand and take on board the scriptures of Islam. So that's my favorite, particularly for non-Muslims and Muslims as well. I certainly learned a huge amount from it. So do you have any concluding words, Jonathan, before we wrap up?
Thanks for having me on. That's my concluding word. And I'm happy that you sort of let me ramble on.
Your rambling is always edificatory and interesting. So once again, thank you very much, Dr. Jonathan Brown, for your time. I'll put a link to the two books I mentioned, primary ones, Misquoting Muhammad and Islam and Blackness, in the description below. And if you haven't got them, get them both. They're both worth your time, and share them with friends as well. So, assalamu alaikum, until next time. Thank you.
Thank you.